This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, Wa usalli wa usallam ala Sayyid al Awaleen wal Akhireen, Nabiyyina Muhammadin, wa ala alihi wa sahbihi, wa barak wa sallam. All praise are due to Allah, Lord of the worlds, and peace and blessings be constantly showered upon our beloved Prophet Muhammad, the master of the first and the last, and upon his family, his companions, and all those who call to his way and establish his sunnah to the day of judgment. As to what follows, my beloved brothers and sisters, to our friends, to our viewers, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Alhamdulillah, we thank Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for the privilege in being able to reflect upon the history of Islam, and especially to be able to focus on a current event, the event that took place in Qatar, the World Cup, and the significance of the great victories of the Moroccan team, very relevant issues that are coming out of that. And this has been a series that studied the history, that went back deeply into the history of this Mediterranean region, and also brought out some of the important facts and important events that took place over the centuries. Many people were shocked at the level of enthusiasm that the Moroccan people had, that Muslims had throughout the Muslim world when these victories took place. First, the victory over Spain, and then the victory over Portugal. And this was a great triumph. But those who understand history, those who understand the relationship between North Africa and Spain and Portugal, realize the level of intensity was based upon a historical reality that people have lived for centuries. And so we have been going behind the vault, so to speak, to unearth information, to bring it forward, to put it together so that we can have a logical understanding, which is a factually based, authenticated, based understanding of what happened in that region. And then also learn something else about ourselves. And so this is the last session. And this session actually contains some information that 90% of the people who I've brought this to over the years did not have any clue about. And so this is a real treasure chest at the end of our course, and hopefully it will open up the doors for future research. Now, in looking at Muslims in the Mediterranean, in Spain, Portugal, North Africa, and then the extension into the early Americas, we need to reflect upon the issue of Islamic civilization in Europe. Again, this is a deconstruction of terminologies, because normally when we speak of Europe and Islam, especially in Spain, it appears to be a type of invasion of people of color from the south who invaded into Europe and plundered and exploited and then were driven out. What we understood was something totally different, that the movement of Muslims into this part of the world and the international nature of the Muslim Ummah and what Allah had willed in terms of our being sort of a bridge between the ancient world of the Greeks and the Romans and the Egyptians and the Syrians and ancient India and China and the rest of the world, that position that we were in, to take the knowledge of the ancient ones and to put it into usable form, to make it relevant to the changes that people were going through. What this actually did was bring a new phase into Europe. And it could be said that we actually introduced tolerance and civil involvement, and you know, we increased the understanding of science and the arts. We were able to revive the knowledge of the ancient Greeks, the mathematics, the philosophy, and to literally take Europe from its dark ages into a type of renaissance or a type of rebirth that we are still living in today. And so to deconstruct this and put it back, we could say Islamic civilization in Europe. And this should be studied as part of European history, as part of world history, and not just an aside that is studied by students in universities who take Islamic studies courses. No, this Renaissance was of critical importance to the history of Europe, and now we can see we are still living with the fruits of this Renaissance, whether they be positive fruits or rotten fruits, but we're living in it. And so this is the first understanding that we need in order to fully recognize what happened with Islam or Muslims in the Americas. We also recognize that with the height of civilization that Muslims had gone to, that we were guilty in a sense of bringing ourselves down. And it's not right for us to continue to blame people on the outside for what happened to us. No doubt they had an influence, but the real issue is in ourselves. And we had learned that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has told us in his glorious book in Surah Al-Ra'd and in other places, إِنَّ اللَّهَ لَا يُغَيْرُ مَا بِقَوْمٍ حَتَّى يُغَيْرُ مَا بِأَنفُسِهِمْ. Allah will not change the condition of a people until they change that which is in themselves. So you can look at this in two ways. That if people are in a lowly condition, that Allah will not change their condition until they begin to change their bad qualities in their hearts and in their practices. But the other way is that if Muslims are in high position or people are in high positions, they're very strong and they change themselves. They become greedy. They become tribalistic. They love the life of this world. Then Allah will change their conditions. So they will go from a lofty position to a lowly position. And we studied this and we saw what happened in Andalus over and over again. Of course, it's a long period of time. We're talking about 781 years plus, really 800 years of active Muslim participation, starting from 711 with Tariq ibn Ziyad, Mazda's great victory over the Trinitarians, and then ending in a sense at 1492, but Muslims were still there. And we want to look after 1492. So this is the area we're opening up, which very few have actually ventured into. And it's very interesting. So an overabundance of wealth, squabbling about power, tribalism, leaving the Sunnah, fighting against each other, splitting hairs and your arguments. This opened up the door for the Trinitarian attack from the north, and it continued and continued until we were knocked down and out of power. Now again, just for terminology's sake and for our understanding of what happened afterwards, we need to review the fact that some scholars even estimate that over 2 million Jews and 3 million Muslims were killed or exiled during the period of the Trinitarian conquest of Al-Andalus. And the Muslims, when the Trinitarian Catholics conquered a certain area, and Muslims had the great civilization, they were the artisans, they were the people who were organizing society. The Jewish people were also very powerful in education, very powerful in wealth management. And so they needed to do something with us, control us, but not get rid of us, because they didn't have the civilization. And so in this case, the Muslims in general were labeled as Moors. So that's why you see Othello in Shakespeare, the Moor. And you'll still see some people using this terminology. But we have to recognize that it comes from moros, which means dark-skinned people in Latin. So it's like saying colored people. It's like saying Negro people in America. That's the same term that was being used. Negro in Spanish means black. And so in the conquered areas, the Muslims who submitted were called Mudahares. And that comes from Mudajjal, or Mudajjan. And the Spanish, they say Mudahares, they don't pronounce the J. And so Mudajjal is somebody who is like living in a lie, Dajjal. Okay, so these are Muslims who submitted and thought that they were still practicing their Islam, but they submitted to the Trinitarian authority, and they lived within those conquered areas. And later on, when the next stage of colonization and oppression happened, the Muslims were then forced to baptize. And this is the Inquisition. This is where you are put in front of an inquisitor, and if you don't accept Trinity, you could be burned alive. So this would include Muslims, Jews, even people amongst the Christians who believed in one God, who refused to accept the Council of Nicaea. So in this case, those who did not die at the stake or fight to their death or migrate, they were baptized, became Christians, went to church, did everything they had to do, but inside they were still Muslims. So these people are known as Morescos. And you could say a Christian Moor, in a sense. Baptized Moor. The Jews were known as Morenos or Conversos. So these are the terminologies that are being used. And when you go through Spanish history, after 1492, Portuguese history, and you start to look at the colonies and the expansions, then you'll see these terminologies coming up. Most people do not understand the significance of the term Morescos or Morenos. Very significant term. And you mark my word, you will see heads of state, individuals in Latin America, in Central America, you're going to see this name Morenos. It's going to come up in front of your eyes. And now you know where that came from. The Islamic response to this oppression was resistance. And that is the word jihad. There's no holy war in Islam. War is not holy. But this is a resistance. So you try to resist as much as you possibly can. And if you can't do that, then you make hijrah, and that is migration. So you will leave the conquered areas if you can't resist, and you will go to a Darul Islam or a place where Islam is freely practiced. Okay? And we also learned that scholars were encouraging those Muslims who were forced to stay in the area, you can resist as well. But they resisted silently. They resisted inside of themselves. And we learned that Bu Juma, you know, in the early 16th century, the Mufti from Wahran in what is now Algeria, gave them a system to resist. And that is that you have to be Catholic on the outside. You can't show any inkling of Islam. If you took a bath on Thursday night, you could die. You have to eat pork publicly. They had to drink wine. But resist on the inside. If you want to make tahara, wudu, then you can tap the wall. That's tayammum. So you're walking down the street. You want to pray, pray with your eyes. You want to take a full ghusl or bath, then say bismillah to yourself. Swim in the water. Your whole body's touched. Your weddings have to be done in the church, funerals, in the Catholic form, in the middle of the night, do a janazah, do a nikah. So there was actually a system set up that Muslims could resist and continue the struggle. But that wasn't enough, because after a period of time, how much can you resist? Your children are growing up in this background, very difficult to live under these conditions. And so people were leaving out of Portugal and Spain in large numbers. And these are refugees to a certain extent. We would say muhajirin. They are people who are migrants who are leaving. And these migrants spread all over the Muslim world, all over North Africa, especially Morocco and Libya and to Egypt, Tunisia, but actually in Turkey, Turkey, Istanbul, all over the Muslim world. And even we're now going to find out to other parts of the world that they actually spread as well. Many of them who could not actually run away and were trying to leave, they might have been captured and made slaves. And they were put on the boats. And this is why when you talk about Christopher Columbus, and remember in 1492, when Abu Abdullah signed the treaty to give away Granada, Columbus was there. And he offered a means of getting riches to the Spanish in the New World. And so there's documented proof, I'm not saying 100%, but there's very strong proof that Columbus himself was Jewish. And he was providing also a way for the conversos, the Jewish people, to be able to go into the New World and to be able to, you know, live their lives somehow in that part of the world. And I was surprised to find out when I lived in Jamaica for 4 years that if you really trace the heritage of Portuguese people, now people in Guyana, Trinidad, but especially Guyana and Jamaica, there's a lot of people of Portuguese descent who are living there. And I was introduced to some information through a Christian minister in the archives, because we were discussing the prime minister at the time, Mr. Edward Siaga, was known to be Lebanese, because there's a lot of Lebanese and Syrians. They're all called Syrians, you know, in the Caribbean area. And he was known as Lebanese, but his mother was Da Costa. Da Costa was his mother. That's his Portuguese name. And when they traced the lineage, Da Costa was Jewish. So when the Jewish people came over as refugees on the boats, They had Portuguese names. They hid within that Converso identity. And later on, when the British came and they offered freedom of religion, then they came out and they announced that they were Jewish. So some say the oldest synagogue in the Western world is in Jamaica. Others say it's in Barbados. It's the same type of issue that happened, that when the British gave our freedom of religion, then they actually were able to establish a synagogue. Muslims were not so fortunate because we were at odds. Our civilization was in struggle. So therefore, the colonial powers could not allow Muslims really to come to the surface. So what we're having here now, visualize Portugal, Spain, and then waves of people coming out. And especially you will see the Portuguese in the beginning, they are really the masters of the sea. And that is because that the ports of the Islamic Navy was actually in Portugal, because that's the one that's facing the Atlantic, Lisbon. Lisbon was the main base for Islamic naval operations. So it was the Portuguese, really, who were the first from Al-Andalus to come out, you know, as a group. And then, of course, the Spanish were following along, you know, after that. And the Spanish are stronger than the Portuguese because of the size of the country. So you have people escaping, enslaved. You have some people resisting in any possible way that they could. So that was the scene. And we want to look at the history after Columbus from our perspective, not from the perspective that is coming to you in the history books, sometimes in the movies. We want to look at it from our perspective. And one of the groups that became popular in terms of resistance, it was called the Barbary Pirates. And of course, pirates have come into our literature, even into our movies and as our stars, pirates with the skull and the crossbones, which is really a Masonic sign. But anyhow, it's all mixed up and confused. But remember, when you say Barbary Pirates, Barbary is Berber. Remember, the Berber is Amazigh. So the Amazigh are the North African people. And so these were literally people on the sea. We use the term sometimes corsairs, which is like the Turkish, you know, navy and others. So literally the Berber Muslim corsairs and the other people, Muslims who were struggling in the Mediterranean region, this is really what the original Barbary pirates were. Okay, they were literally Mujahideen in many cases. Of course, some of them got into the plunder and whatnot, but primarily they were Mujahideen who were struggling against the Portuguese and the Spanish. Now, this is an artist's conception of what the Barbary pirates might have looked like, as you can see. And that's something much different than the pirates that you see in the movies. However, if you look closely, if the people who are making the movies about pirates are honest, you're going to see a lot of Islamic culture actually in their clothes and in some of the things that they're doing. Okay? So these are the Barbary pirates. And probably the most famous of the Barbary pirates for the Muslims, I mean, even really, you know, for the Spanish, you know, and the Portuguese, was a set of brothers named Barbarossa. Barbarossa. And the brothers are Urij and Khairuddin. They are the most famous of this set of brothers who were actually first independent corsairs on the ocean. And then later on, they became involved with the Ottoman Empire. Okay? So these are Barbarossa brothers. And the name, actually, Barbarossa, it comes from the Italian meaning red beards. Okay? There's something coming from downstairs. And hopefully, you know, we're gonna straighten that out with the people downstairs. Yeah. So, nice background for our last class, but inshallah we'll end soon. So, the Barbarossa brothers, okay? And the most famous became Khairuddin, Khairuddin Barbarossa. And Barbarossa actually means red beard. And if you looked up the word Barbarossa, you see some mention of them, but most of them is famous red-bearded Europeans who were kings or leaders or whatever. But this is how they became known, because the older brother, he actually had a reddish beard. And then his younger brother, Khairuddin, he dyed his beard red when he got older, you know, because this was sort of like their reputation. What is interesting about that is that one of the corsairs, English corsair, you know, and this is a person who was a naval fighter for the British. His name was Jack Ward, or John Ward. Okay, and it was said about him, and this was said, you go back to the 17th century, it was said that he was, beyond a doubt, the greatest scoundrel that ever sailed from England. Look at this, they call him a scoundrel, right? This is the British ambassador, English ambassador to Venice. He said this to the Venetians because Jack Ward was you know, a privateer first for Queen Elizabeth, right? Remember, the British are fighting the Spanish. Remember the Spanish-English war, the Armada, and all of that struggle that's going on. And so he was first fighting against the Spanish, and then because of disappointments that he had, you know, with the English, you know, leadership, he went on his own. And he won some great victories. He eventually captured a major vessel around 1603, and he sailed to Tunis, to Tunisia. And it's a long story, but basically he and his crew eventually converted to Islam. Okay, so this is now Jack Ward, Captain Jack Ward. Okay, and his name became Yusuf Rais. So that was his Muslim name. And he was very successful. He became very rich. And he lived in Tunisia there until he died from the plague at around 70 years old. Now, where's the confusion, the trichnology, the wrong information that comes to us? That is that one of the popular movies, you know, of the 21st century, one of the popular movies is called Pirates of the Caribbean. Okay, and Johnny Depp, you know, so you can see him in the middle. And this is a very famous series, you know, of movies. But actually, his name is Jack Sparrow. So if you follow into the movie, his name is Jack as well, right? He actually took the role of Captain Jack Ward. And the dress, of course, they have this fantastic dress. And it's a supernatural story that they develop with zombies and all types of strange things. Okay, but the original story, okay, was Captain Jack Ward, not Captain Jack Sparrow. And if you look at the pictures here, you'll see some depictions that were made by Muslims of Jack Ward in his height. Also, you know, drawings that were done of him in his fight, you know, against the British, against Spanish. He became a great hero in the Muslim world, especially in North Africa. So again, this is history, true history, or his story, right? So his story is Jack Sparrow, right? That's the confusion. But the real history is Captain Jack Ward. And he was actually part of the resistance movement. So this is the resistance. Now again, We have to recognize, why is there such a reaction amongst the Moroccans, the North Africans, to defeating the Spanish in a little soccer game? Because constant confusion that was going on, fighting that was happening over centuries between North Africa and Portugal, but especially Spain. And the Spanish, when they left from Spain and went into the Atlantic, and Columbus then bumped into America on his way to India, they recognized that there were lands across the sea. They recognized that there was potentially gold there, there was power there. There are so many products that actually came from the Americas into Europe and into other parts of the world. You'd be shocked to know that corn, that everybody eats corn all over the world, it comes from Mexico. That's where it originated. That tomatoes originated in this part of the world. Potatoes, and you think of potatoes with the Irish people in the famine. Potatoes actually originated in the Americas. And during the Great Famine, it was one of the sultans, you know, of the Ottomans, who sent boatloads of potatoes to the Irish people that they could survive. So potatoes are not Irish. It comes from the Americas. So there was a lot there in the Americas, 73 million people. You know, 2,000 separate languages. Great civilizations like Aztecs and Incas and Mayans. North America, you know, amazing groups of the indigenous people. The basis of the Constitution of the United States actually came from the Iroquois Confederacy. Because Benjamin Franklin, remember, when the United States is putting themselves together as a country, they needed a constitution. So how could you have separate states? There were 13 colonies in early America. How could these separate states confederate to be one union? They didn't have a good example of this coming out of Europe. Benjamin Franklin went amongst the Iroquois, and he found that there was a confederacy amongst the Iroquois and other First Nations people, that they had put themselves together in a six-nation confederacy, and so many of their concepts were put into the Constitution of the United States. You look at the early dress of Americans, moccasins, that we're still wearing our moccasins, and we're still wearing, you know, our leather coats, our raccoon caps. None of this came from Europe. This is the dress of the indigenous people. So really, the Portuguese and the Spanish, they looked at the conquest of the Americas as part of their, Reconquista, or their so-called reconquest of Al-Andalus. And it was to raise the Catholic banner throughout the world. That's how they looked at it. And they were given permission by their leaders to do whatever they wanted. The area in the Americas was called empty land. So you can do whatever you want in terms of the people themselves. And of course, because these conquistadors, Spanish, were coming out of hot wars with the Muslims, they were paranoid. Every place they went, they were afraid Muslims were going to come back at them again. This is the reason why when the Spanish eventually made it around and they went to the Philippines, they saw Muslims there in Mindanao, and they said Moros. So they called them Moors because they were Muslims. They were Malay Muslims, Filipinos. And up until now, the Moro Liberation Front is a name that they use, you know, there in the Philippines. And when Hernan Cortez, who conquered Mexico through treachery and disease, when he arrived in the Yucatan area, and then he called this area El Cairo. This is what they were all seeing. When Columbus went around in Cuba, and he looked up and he said, Mesquita, there is a masjid on the top of this hill. That's in the memoirs of Christopher Columbus. So it was colonization for the Spanish as they went out. And what you have to recognize, which most people are not aware of, is that on the boat of Christopher Columbus and Vasco da Gama and Balboa and all the different Portuguese and Spanish conquistadors, most of the people who were doing the work were Muslims, Morescos, because they were the ones who had the naval skills. Financing was being done by Morenos, right? The Jewish people hid their identity, okay? And there were even laws. They needed labor to go into the ocean, because for the average Portuguese-Spanish person, it's a frightening thing to go into the Atlantic Ocean. Atlantic Ocean is not a friendly ocean. It's cold and it's windy. So therefore, what they did was, any Moresco who was found guilty, right, of any lesser acts of heresy, right, which did not warrant death, if they were not going to kill you, then they put you on the boats. So they would condemn you to perpetual service as a galley slave. So these are the ones rowing the boats. These are the ones, you know, who are there. And, you know, it's strange, but if you were circumcised, if the male was circumcised, that's a form of heresy. That's like disbelief, you know, with them. And instead of killing you, they just make you a galley slave for the rest of your life. King Philip II ordered the Inquisition to sentence to the galleys without question anyone found guilty of performing circumcisions. So if you performed the circumcision, you could also be made a galley slave. And so this is the reason why there's so many Muslims, Morescos, who are Muslims hiding their identity, and Morenos, who are on the boats that are coming across. In the 16th century, Cardinal Jimenez Cisneros, he was the Grand Inquisitor of Spain, right? And, you know, he was called the missionary to the Moors. He complained that Islam was openly being practiced in the Americas. This is a complaint that he made. He said that people coming back are saying, there's Islam on the other side. And he's accusing Morescos of practicing Islam on the other side. And some of the proofs of this, we even have a written proof that is coming. In 1560, there was an inquisition made by the Spanish in Peru because they wanted to weed out people who would not be Catholics. And they executed Lope de la Peña and his cohort Luis Solano for practicing and spreading Islam in Peru. Think about this. That's South America. Okay, now the Spanish, one of the things that they used to do is they would burn all records that people had. Any writing that you had, when they conquer you, they burn it, and they would hide their own records. But there are things coming to the surface. On July 31st, 1502, Columbus reported, and in his memoirs, that he came across this boat. It crossed them. It was 40 feet in length, and he described it as a Moorish ship. This is off the coast of Jamaica. And there was 40 men and women, and some of them were dressed in Moorish cloth because they knew the pattern. They said the men wore this top that had short sleeves, and some of the women covered their face, and they crossed them on the ocean. And Columbus put it in his memoirs, but this is not revealed to the average people. But there are reports like this. We also recognize within open written records, again, it's truth hidden in plain sight, that a man by the name of Estevanico of Azanmore. Okay, Estevanico is a famous person in the United States now, especially in Arizona and New Mexico. Why? Because he was part of the ill-fated expedition 1527, right? You know, they landed in Florida. This is a Spanish group landing in Florida. Okay, so he stayed in the Americas. Who was he? His name was actually Mustafa Azanmori. Azanmori was a small town in Morocco. Okay, so it's right on the coast in Sila, you know, in that area, Azan Moor. So he was Mustafa Azan Mori. And because of this Moresco thing, how he was captured or whatever it is, he had to hide his identity. And he was a Moresco traveling with them. And so this ill-fated group, they ended up in Florida, okay? And they eventually traveled across the Americas. Now, if you look at this map here, you will see the arrows pointing. They wanted to spend time. They were in Cuba first. Then they went up to Florida. They were forced to stay there. But this party, along with some of the indigenous people, they traveled across, follow the arrow. You will see they went to New Orleans and that area, then across where Texas is, and right across down into Mexico. And they went up into what is now Arizona and New Mexico. Okay, and so he was really one of the first. He's known, they have statues of him down in New Mexico. Estevanico, they call him. But he was really, they say Estevanico the Moor. So they would even recognize the Moor. Okay, so this again, these are Muslims somehow coming across and having an impact in the Americas. Okay, it's knowledge hidden in plain sight. In 1566, now this is before the British, right? The Spanish established St. Helena, South Carolina, one of their bases of operations. But it was captured by the English in 1567. Now, many of the inhabitants of St. Helena fled into the mountains. So they went, because there's a mountain chain there, they went up into this Appalachian, this mountain chain, South Carolina, especially North Carolina, and then you go into the high Appalachians. So they fled into the area. So this is a Spanish colony now. And the colony, the workers in the colony, to a great extent, are made up of these galley slaves and the people who, many of them, are actually Muslims. And this is a map of what America used to look like. And it's shocking for a lot of people whose minds are only fixed upon the borders today. If you look on the right side, the 13 colonies of America only is where the darkened portion is on the right side. That's what America originally was. When independence, you know, was called and the Constitution and all that, they didn't have California. They didn't have the Midwest. None of that. They eventually started to expand and they bought territory, they fought for territory. The French sold them what they call Louisiana in 1803. So that area is right up north. It goes right up north to really to the borders where Canada is, because this is where the British were up in the north. But in the Midwest, that was French territory. And then the Spanish-American Wars, and what was going on. Now look at Spanish Mexico. So the area now that we now know as New Mexico, Arizona, California, right, even Nevada and these areas, right, this was actually Spanish territory. This is Mexico. And that's the reason why the Spanish language is now, you know, the top language after English in America right now. They're the fastest growing minority. Because actually a great part of this country was part of the indigenous, we say Spanish, but it's really Latino. They are indigenous people who lived in this area. And the great Aztec civilization, they had pyramids. So it was a powerful civilization. They're not weak people. But that's all covered over with his story. So you have the Alamo fighting against the Mexicans. And now you see the Latino people, Mexicans, on the border trying to get into the United States to say, why are you foreigners coming in? That was their territory before. It's only a couple hundred years, right? So some of them want to go home when they're actually trying to cross the border. What is important to understand now is that the British were fighting the Spanish. So even though the British, who were coming as a world power, remember the first powers is you know, first coming out of Portugal and Spain, right, because of Al-Andalus. And then the French now get really strong because they conquer some areas. Now the British start to come on. And the British were in competition with the Spanish, fighting them. And so the old saying, you know, the you know, my enemy, you know, and your enemy, you know, we're friends because we both have the same enemy. So Muslims then became, in a sense, fairly friendly with the British. And it is shocking the influence that the Ottomans and Islamic culture had upon the British. Maybe that's part of the reason why Islam is the fastest growing religion in the UK today. You know, the major food. What is the most popular dish, you know, in the UK? It used to be fish and chips. What is it now? Butter chicken. It's the butter chicken curry, right? That's the most popular dish in the UK. More than fish and chips, which was their main meal. What is the most popular name in Britain today? Okay? It's Muhammad. That's the most popular name of people if you go by the census. It used to be Harry. But there's a background to this. It's very interesting background. Because Britain, the English, they were one of the first people to actually start adopting coffee, drinking coffee outside the Muslim world. Coffee had come from Ethiopia, and then it went to Yemen. The Ottomans took it, made it international. They started making coffee houses. And these coffee houses in Istanbul and in Ottoman lands was a place where you gather together, where you talk, and sometimes politics and all kinds of things go on in coffee houses. The British adopted this. And at first, it was frowned upon. They drink their beer. They have their own. But now, these coffee houses became places for intellectuals. And coffee was a Muslim drink. Now, could you imagine this? Coffee was a Muslim drink. It was not a European drink. Tell an American now, his Dunkin' Donuts. Tell a Canadian, Tim Hortons, was a Muslim drink that you're drinking. It would be shocking to them. So there was a lot of cooperation that went on in the 16th century between the British and the Muslims. Look at this picture here. This is Abdu'l-Wahid ibn Mas'ud ibn Muhammad ibn Anun. Now, he was the principal secretary to the Moroccan ruler, Moulay Ahmed al-Mansur. And he was the ambassador to the court of Queen Elizabeth I of England in 1600 to promote the establishment of Anglo-Moroccan alliance. Look at how he's dressed. Look at his turban. Look at his sword. He's the ambassador to the court. Today, they would think he's a terrorist. This is the ambassador. And Muslims in those days had izzah. They didn't put on suits and ties. Right? They wore their dress. And they influenced other societies. And this is interesting because in 1586, Sir Francis Drake, who was one of the greatest admirals of the British, fighting the Portuguese and the Spanish on the oceans, it is reported that with 30 ships, he raided the Portuguese in Brazil. He freed 300 Moorish galley slaves. Okay? Now, he wanted to drop them off maybe in Cuba or somewhere else. He ended up in Roanoke, Virginia. The island is Virginia, off the coast of Virginia. And the British people who were suffering at that time in America, they wanted to go home. So he left off the 300 Moorish galley slaves. He left them off in Roanoke. Okay? And there are other Spanish records, you know, talking about the Moors. Now, generally, they would say Moors. The English, in their records, when you go through their records, they are less generic. Now, they would describe, for instance, the galley slaves like this. They say Turks, Moors, Greeks, Frenchmen, and Negroes. So that would be Africans. Okay, so they try to get more specific, although Negro, you know, is not a specific term. Many of those African people could have been Muslims, you know, as well. Moor is a vague term as well, right? That's a vague term. Okay, now look at these records. These are American records. In 1654, English explorers learned from the Southeast indigenous people of bearded Portuguese silversmiths. They were said to drop to their knees many times daily and pray. And they said many of them, they were bearded. What do you think that they were doing? Dropping to their knees. They were making salat. That's in American record books. Now, the term that they use, you'll see it over and over again. They say Portuguese or Guichi or Portuguese. They would generally describe this group as Portuguese group. Okay? In 1784, Tennessee Governor John Sevier, he met with some of these people. He put it in his records. In 1700, Jonathan Swift, an Englishman, married what he called Mecca Indian. He called her a Mecca Indian. Now, this is a picture of one of these people, you know, who were there. And the term is being called Melungeons. Now, as far as the 18th century, these Melungeons, you know, they recognize they were Moorish descent. Now, Judge Lewis Shepherd, who had defended a Melungeon girl, that's a picture of her. Look what she looks like in the picture. He had defended a Melungeon girl in a famous Tennessee case in 1872 regarding interracial marriage. Because white people, European people, are not supposed to marry natives that they call Indians or Africans that they call blacks, right? They're not supposed to do that. But he defended her and he said they were Portuguese Moors. Because if you, technically speaking, if you say Portuguese, it's European. That's her. And you can see the way she looks. So this is the group now. It is not Afro-Americans. It is not Native Indigenous Americans. They are not regular Europeans. They're something different. And they're not actually Portuguese. If you really look at their DNA, they're not actually Portuguese. That's the question. So the Melungeon, there's a lot of discussion about this. That's the term they started to be known as. And in Turkish, it means people whose life has been cursed. And in some reports, they say Mel'un Jan. Mel'un is even from Arabic. It's like cursed. And Jan in Turkish could be like life. The person's life, you know, has been cursed. Mel'un Jan, Melungeon. And this group is identified in the Appalachian regions in the United States. Okay, especially West Virginia and places, that's Appalachians, right? High North Carolina. Now, that's one of the Melungeon groups. Look at the people there. Look at their faces. In 1990, Dr. James Guthrie found that blood samples of these people were the same as the population of North Africa, Turkey, Iraq, and the Mediterranean region. Because then they were studying blood, right? They had reached the point where they could get samples and look in your DNA and they're looking at your blood. He said, no, wait a minute. This is like Turkish, North African, Iraqi, Mediterranean. And they also suffered from a disease, sarcoidosis. This is a nerved-based disease. And it is, people of North Africa have this disease, Mediterranean people. They suffered from it. And so Melungeons, some call Christianized Portuguese Moors. That's a mouthful there. Christianized Portuguese Moors. Okay? And they say these people must have fled to America because of the Inquisition. That was the only way that they could put it together. Because Moors, again, they don't realize what Moors actually means. Moors is Muslims. because that's the general term, as we learned, that was being used for the Muslims in the conquered areas of Spain. That's one of the Melungeons. Now, today, what's interesting is that the Melungeons can be found today all over the United States, especially on the East Coast. And they were usually classified as a separate people. They're not classified as black, white, or Indian. They're a separate group. And they're all over the place. It's really Southeast America that you find the most. Brent Kennedy, who is one of the Melungeons, he actually wrote a book, The Melungeons. And what he showed, he did a study. It was based upon his sarcoidosis. He was trying to find out a cure for this nerve-based disease. And then he realized this is a North African, Mediterranean type of, you know, condition. And then he started tracing, and all these things start coming forward. And he wrote this book called The Melungeons. Now, what he found out is if you live in the southeast part of America, and your name is one of these names, you could be Melungeon. Adams, Adkins, Bell, Bennett, Berry, Bowling, Chavis, Coleman, Collins, Gibson, Goins, Hall, Jackson, Lopez, Moore, Mullins, Nash, Robinson, Sexton, and Williams. Now, amongst African Americans, especially in this part, these are popular names. And I literally taught a class in New York about this issue some years ago, and one of the sisters said, I'm a Melungeon. She never knew that. She always knew that her family was something different. And she said, I'm one of the Melungeons. And it's shocking. Again, these are people who came from Spain, Portugal, North Africa, who came across after Columbus. Who are some of the famous Melungeons? This is a shock too for people. Andrew Jackson, President of the United States. Okay. Nancy Hanks, the mother of President Abraham Lincoln. His mother was Melungeon. This is heavy if you want to rewrite American history. His mother might have Muslim roots. You want to rewrite the history of this country and really bring out the actual story. And this one will really change things for a lot of people, not this generation so much, but you know, little generation before. Elvis Presley. How many people love Elvis? He's Melungeon. Look at Elvis's face. Look at that look. If you put on, you know, the Emirati, you know, Iqal and whatnot, look at him. He's a Saudi, he looks like. Look at his look. This is the Melungeon look. And again, you have to realize what America actually is. It is a melting pot of different peoples. It is a country that has gone through transitions. And this is not a long time ago. They purchased the Midwest in 1803. So you're talking, you know, only like 220 years ago. That's not a long time if you look at world history. What's 220 years? The Muslims were in Al-Andalus 781 years in power. This is only 220 years. So this is not a long history, but because of the power of the media, the power of miseducation, the power of the technologies, people's brains, you know, have been washed, as they say, cognitive dissonance, you know, knowledge has been taken out of their brains. We want to bring it back to the surface. Now, colonial soldiers of the Revolutionary War. Now, these are Muslims. Some of them came from the African enslaved Muslims as well. Some of them could have come from the Melungeons, other people. Look at some of the names. These are recorded names. Yusuf Ben Ali. He was known as Joseph Ben Haley. He fought with General Sumter in South Carolina. 1732, right? Bampit Mohammed. He was a corporal in the Revolutionary War. That's when the Americans fought the British for their independence. Okay, this is his service records, 1775 to 1783. It's in Virginia. Peter Salim, it was probably Salim. His slave name was Peter Buckminster, who fought in Massachusetts in early 1970s. He was honored in 1970s with a postage stamp. Salim Poor, they call Salim Poor, he fought in Massachusetts, became a war hero, right? Francis Sabah, or Sabah, he was a sergeant with the Continental Troops, 1775. Joseph Sabah was also with Continental Troops. So these are names of actual people who fought in the war. But we never got credit for this. But it is actually part of American history and the history of the West that should be recognized. And this is one of the most interesting covered points. And that is that when the United States, remember those 13 colonies, they didn't have the Midwest, they did not have California. They were just starting off. They were trying to break away from the British. It was Morocco. It was Al-Maghrib. They were the first to recognize the United States of America. And this here is an actual copy of the treaty. It's in Arabic and in English. And you can go to Tangiers, Tanja. You know, there's a special museum that's there, where they actually house this treaty. This is really interesting point. Okay, it was a Muslim country that recognized the United States first. So how are you going to come along and make a Muslim ban? As in the case of President Trump, he banned Muslims. Like you're foreigners. He doesn't even know his own history. That it was a Muslim country that recognized the United States. And this is an actual picture, like depicting of George Washington on the right and Sultan Muhammad ibn Abdullah on the left, right? The Sultan of Morocco. This is a treaty that was made. So this is now Muslims in the Americas. This is the influence that we have had. An influence that is still there today because Islam still is the fastest growing religion. Now even Hispanic people, Latino people are embracing Islam as well, recognizing their roots. So that influence is there, needs to be in the mind of our people. That is how you decolonize your mind. That is how you take out the lies of Columbus discovering America, right? With solid information. Now we can go back and reflect to the beginning of our courses, right? Morocco defeats Spain. Look at the reaction, unprecedented reaction. Morocco defeats Spain. Morocco defeats Portugal. It was a historic victory. Look at the thousands of Moroccans marching in the streets. And you would say, why would the people be so emotional, crying tears, falling on the ground? Why would they be so emotional over a soccer game? Because it means more than just kicking the ball in the net. Right? This is part of payback, you know, for what happened over the centuries. And it is a historic struggle. So for those of you who want some references for this, there is, in Arabic, there's a book by Dr. Ali Kattani, Inbi'ath al-Islam fil Andalus. It may be, I'm not sure if it's translated, but it's an excellent book if you can have it for Arabic-speaking people. And along with the other books that I recommended, this is N. Brent Kennedy, right? His book is called The Melungeons. The Resurrection of a Proud People, An Untold Story of Ethnic Cleansing in America. So you can get this book at the Mercer University Press. And Dr. Umar Farooq Abdullah, who is a well-known Islamic scholar, American scholar, he did an article called Turks, Moors, and Morescos in Early America. It's an excellent article as well. Right, and this is where you can get it. His group is An-Nawawi, an-nawawi.org. Okay, is the name of his group. And it's an excellent article, you know, there as well. Okay, so I want to open up the floor for any questions that anybody may have, you know, concerning the Muslims in the Americas after Columbus. Okay, floor is open. Can you see if Tahmid is he there? Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
I have a question from the previous class. We kind of went through that South America was, but the Americas were discovered before Columbus. So the Muslims that were on Christopher's boat, did they know that it was already discovered before they went on that discovery?
Yeah, actually, Columbus himself knew that people were going back and forth. So you know, you see in his memoirs, he said dugout canoes are leaving West Africa, and they're going across, you know, into the ocean. So he knew, and he probably informed the Morescos who were on the boat because they were looking for land. And it is said that one of the Morescos, Rodrigo de Triana, he was actually the first person to sight land because this is in the Bahamas. But Columbus, of course, took credit for it. But it was one of the Morescos who sighted land first. Okay, and but it was a shock for everybody when they actually stepped on land on the other side, because for centuries the Europeans thought that this ocean cannot be crossed. Muslims knew that there was something across. Muslims had records, but the Europeans didn't know this, right? So it was an opening for them, you know. And then they realized, and then so many so-called explorers went across from different origins. Yes, so I mean, he would not say himself, you know, I discovered America, unless he was totally insane, you know, because the people are there, right? Yeah. So how can you say I discovered the place when people are looking at you, right? You have to be out of your mind. But somebody who wants to exploit history for domination would then say, we discovered America, meaning you take credit for it. You're the first civilized people. The other people who are living there are animals, right? And we're the first civilized people who came. That's the colonial mentality. That's domination. It's educational imperialism is what it actually is. We want to see if there's any questions online that anybody has. We don't actually have records of Morescos in Canada itself. No, there are records of African Muslim ex-slaves who came up, because you have to recognize that there was slavery in Canada as well, not just in America. So there was slavery. But really, the northern part here, Jacques Cartier and the Europeans who first came in... generally speaking, the people who went across, if you look at the equatorial currents, because they were following the currents that take you from Spain or from North Africa, it will take you right into Brazil or into Barbados or right up into, you know, the United States. But they normally went to the south because it was in the south and the Caribbean, South America. That's the fertile place. Not many people wanted to go north because it's too cold. And it was only later that they realized, you know, about the civilizations that were far in the north. Yeah, another question.
So given America and the Muslims had a great relationship up until the Spanish were on their side, at what point did it turn around and they started becoming enemies of them?
Yeah, you know, it's really, you know, the question is, Muslims had a good relationship with America. So at what point did they become enemies? I mean, actually, if you look, America has a good relationship with Morocco up until today, with the government of Morocco. And but it's not based on Islam. It's based upon, controlling the Mediterranean region, North Africa. And there's other reasons, too, because Morocco has phosphates. But America never colonized North Africa. It was the French. And it was the Spanish and the Portuguese, right? The British, it was them. It wasn't America. America was not really a colonial power over there. And it was really not until World War II that America starts to become like a world power. They were really on this part. Their crime was, wiping out the indigenous population and enslaving African people. But as far as North Africa was concerned, they had strategic relationship, with North Africa. And when the American forces, landed, when they first went to fight against the Germans in World War II, they landed in Algeria. My father actually was in the military police, part of the American troops that landed in Algeria. So they first landed in Algeria, North Africa, and then they went. So they loved North Africa. As a matter of fact, the Marines, who were considered to be the bravest, strongest American forces. Of course, now you have Navy SEALs and all these other groups. But before, the Marines are the ones, okay? If you look at the Marines in their anthem, they say, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. That's the Marine, that's the beginning of their anthem. So Montezuma, that's Aztecs, that's Mexico. He's one of the Aztec leaders. Tripoli is North Africa. So they were very much concerned, with North, as they are today, but it's for other strategic regions now. Of course, with the rise of Islam, it starts to change, because now Islam is rising back up as an international power and is a threat to the West based upon, this civilizational threat. So it starts to change. But in terms of the government of Morocco, and no, Americans have a good relationship up until today. There, very good relationship. Okay. Yeah, question.
Where is the mosque found on a hill in Cuba, which Columbus mentioned in his memoir? Was it found, and is it still there?
Yes, it says that he mentions, Mesquita, this is a mosque there, but that was, of course, in the 15th century Columbus. That's long gone. If it was there, it's long gone, and of course, because, of course, even before that, it would have been gone, because the Spanish took over, and they would destroy everything Islamic. And then when it was taken over by Fidel Castro, they are communists. So that there's no trace of it there. The only trace is in the records, in the memoirs. Now.
Yeah. How would you categorize all the different ways that Muslims came to the Americas? So I have, they came as refugees, as explorers, under expeditions under the Spanish and Portuguese.
Yeah. So really, you can look at Muslims coming into the Americas in waves. So the first wave would be as explorers and as business people. And that's the early waves before Columbus. And, we talked about the people then coming in. Then there's a wave that comes after Columbus, and that is the wave of the Morescos and that we studied today. But there is another significant wave that comes in. We haven't studied it in this particular course because we're dealing with Spain, Morocco, and Portugal, Mediterranean. But there's another significant wave, maybe the most significant wave, and that is Africans, African enslaved people. Because we now have proof that somewhere between 15 to 30% of the African enslaved people who were brought to the Americas were Muslims. It's a large percentage of African Americans, Afro-Caribbeans, Afro-South Americans were actually Muslim origin. And records are coming up now, documents are coming here. That's a whole nother study in itself. And then there's another wave coming in, and that is in the 19th century, when they abolished slavery, that is indentured laborers. So when the British, when they abolished slavery, they hired people from India and from Indonesia and Malaysia, Java, to come in to work on a contract. So that's indentured laborers, and that's another wave. The majority were Hindus, but there was a percentage Muslim. That's in Guyana, in Trinidad, in Jamaica. Also in Suriname, there are many Javanese Muslims as well. So that's another significant wave, especially since in the slavery period, the slaves were not allowed to keep their identity. But during the indentured labor period, alhamdulillah, Muslims could keep their identity. So they built masjids, madrasas, you know, and that's the presence of Islam for the most part in the Caribbean, you know, and there today is because of this. But there's another wave, and that is what you could call economic migration. And that is in the 20th century when America needed, and Canada, when they needed people to open up and to settle in the Midwest. Remember the map in the Midwest. If you go back to the map, you will see that that whole center part is they need to colonize it. They need to bring wagon trains and settlers. In Canada, it was the Hudson Bay who actually sold to the early Canada that was on the East Coast. They sold the whole center part of Canada. Who's going to live there? Who's going to go there and live? So therefore, they opened up settlers, colonization. But because they were racist and they ruled with racism, they would only take white people, people who could qualify as white-skinned. And because the British had a relationship with the Ottoman Empire, remember that? They had a relationship. So therefore, they opened up, and they put out signs and advertisements to people, if you want to live a new life, come to Canada, come to America. So many of the people on the wagon trains in the United States, the oldest mosque in America is in the Midwest. The oldest mosque in Canada is in Edmonton, Alberta, a Rashid Mosque. And the first Muslims, you know, known, recorded are Arabs, and they're Turks, and they're Albanians, and they're Muslims coming from the Ottoman Empire. Now, what happened was they ended up in Canada and America, and then they started to migrate south. And they went down through California and into Mexico and into Central America and then down into South America. And when the Arabs reached South America, that's a whole nother study in itself. Because right now there's over 100,000 Arabs in Venezuela, in Caracas. There's a huge masjid. In Brazil, there are more Lebanese in Brazil than Lebanon. Chew on that one. There's more Lebanese in Brazil than in Lebanon in terms of their numbers, because they thrived. They thrived in that land. So if you go to Brazil now in Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro, you find big masjids, Lebanese, Syrians, Palestinians. If you go all over the Caribbean region, Central America, you'll see, I traveled these areas and I ran into Arabs. I can speak Arabic. I ran into Arabs on the Virgin Islands. Arabs control all the gas stations. You know, whatever, you know, if you go down to Aruba and Curaçao, these are Dutch islands off the coast of Venezuela, Arabs, they have huge masjids. If you go to Panama, I met Palestinians flying in helicopters because the canal. Arabs are all over the place. So that's what you could call economic migration. So that's the next wave of Muslims then coming in. And of course, in the 20th century now, you have people embracing Islam amongst the African Americans and Latinos. And then you have people returning to their Islam. So that's what we call deeper roots. That's our study of deeper roots. Okay? And so these are the waves. If you look at it like that, it makes sense, right? You know, then you can see the waves. Of course, there's a lot of complexity inside of it. But you can basically see the waves of Muslims coming into this region. Any other questions online?
No questions.
So, alhamdulillah, this has been, you know, our class, you know, concerning, you know, Muslims in Morocco, Spain, Portugal, North Africa, and then to the Americas. Alhamdulillah, we realize that, you know, Muslims are not confined to one part of the world. We have made great contributions to the upward flow of civilization, even in this part of the world. And so for those who want to continue on in terms of our study, we have a class now on Friday nights where it's called New Muslim Corner, but we're dealing with history and foundations of Islam. It's a popular class now, so we invite you also to come to that class Friday night at 7 o'clock. You can go to www.islam.ca, right? And you can come in just like this class. You can join on the class 7 o'clock on Friday evening. That will be continuing throughout the summer, inshallah, unless there are special occasions or unless I'm traveling, that will continue on, you know, right straight through the summer because we're getting a major response from people. Also, if you're online, Facebook, you can follow our site. It's Sheikh Abdullah Hakim Quick, public figure. So you can come onto our Facebook page or Instagram. And Instagram as well, abdullah.quick. You know, you can catch us on Instagram. And our study continues. Alhamdulillah, we're so thankful for, you know, the your presence and, you know, the interaction, you know, that has happened. And if you've gained any knowledge, you know, out of this, that is from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And any mistakes are mine, and we ask Allah to forgive us for any mistakes. And subhanakallahumma bihamdika, nashhadu an la ilaha illa anta, nastaghfiruka wa natubu ilaik, wa akhira da'wana, and alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.